The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. All right, Fed Wednesday, no doubt about it. We've also got a new edition of Bloomberg Business Week magazine coming out online on the Bloomberg and on newsstands tomorrow officially, Sooner Than You Think issue. And one of the stories gets into the 120 million Americans, Tim, still without high-speed internet access and how now may be their best shot in a generation at getting it.
Yeah, Austin Carr is a technology reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from L.A. Austin, I was actually traveling to a rural area of, well, it's not even that rural, the Catskills, over the weekend. And my friends who live up there just got broadband internet access for the first time in the last couple of years. And this is an area that many people go to and many people rely on because people rely on broadband if they're doing remote work, if they need to apply to jobs. And it's still just mind-boggling that so many Americans do not have access to broadband. Take us into your story and what Washington is doing to get these 120 million Americans who do not have high-speed internet access.
So, yeah, what you witness is in the Catskills is exactly what I witnessed reporting in rural Arkansas, which is it's just a different world than the internet have experienced versus the internet have not. Where I went to in the Arkansas Delta, which is about, a couple hours outside of Little Rock, very remote, very rural parts, high poverty rates, low density population, and, only recently one of the internet providers I talked with had just turned off their dial-up internet, which they had been, charging 50 cents per hour.
Wow.
Since 1995. It's just a different world. You don't realize that they can't stream Netflix there. They can't do Zoom. They can't book a COVID appointment if they don't have internet access. And so what I wanted to show with this story is what it looks like on the ground as Washington considers tackling this digital divide with the infrastructure spending bill, which is making its way through Congress right now. It's through the House as well. And they're considering spending tens of billions of dollars on broadband deployment subsidies and giving us potentially the best shot in many years at really narrowing the gap. And the big debate is, how do we actually do that? What technologies do we invest in? What's the best bang for our buck? And this story shows what it's like, what the reality is like in places like rural Arkansas and what you saw in the Catskills of how much it takes to actually close that divide with infrastructure on the ground.
Well, how much does it take? Because in order for my friends, and I actually spent a lot of time Saturday night talking to them about this because this was the first time I had visited them in the 7 years that they've lived up there that they had high-speed internet. Every other time, they've relied on a satellite to actually get them internet access, and they were capped at 15 gigs a month, which is really nothing. I mean, people use 15 gigs a month in a day if they're streaming something high definition or in a couple days. And I wonder about the way that technology has changed because they actually got cable laid down, which is very expensive. But you see companies like Starlink, Elon Musk's satellite company, being able to offer potentially lower cost solutions. So what's the technology needed here and how much does it cost?
So in the Arkansas Delta, that the big debate is how much do you spend on fiber, which is the gold standard. That's what you have with every high-speed internet pretty much in every wealthier urban part of America at this point. Or do you invest in sort of a riskier technology like Elon Musk's Starlink satellites, which orbit lower part over the Earth and zap coverage from space? There's 5G home internet, which is sort of a home-based version of what you get from, say, T-Mobile or AT&T or Verizon. Or there are fixed wireless tools, which like Citizen Broadband Radio Service, which is actually what a bunch of the local internet providers in Arkansas are using these days. It's a wireless spectrum historically used by the U.S. Navy to sort of beam radar transmissions, and the FCC has repurposed that spectrum for commercial use, allowing local players to sort of beam internet coverage using radio antennas, which sounds kind of old school, but it works for up to 6 miles. It's not as fast or reliable as fiber, but it gives decent speeds and costs a fraction of physically wiring up every home in America. And so this really comes down to this cost-benefit analysis of in rural Arkansas, I'm told it can cost $50,000 or more to get a fiber optic cable laid into the ground, and that's not including trenching costs or construction, et cetera. And so how much are you willing to invest in that versus a far cheaper but maybe less reliable technology that might not be relevant in 10 years, that might need to be eventually replaced in fiber, but will help get more people online tomorrow instead of 10 years from now?
It is still striking how many Americans are without high-speed internet access, because we take it for granted, certainly here on the East Coast. So the infrastructure bill, does that provide enough money to really move the needle here? And what specifically you're getting into some of the technologies? I mean, what needs to be the first couple of steps to move towards hooking up those 120 million Americans?
Yeah, the biggest holdback is actually the FCC's data. It's historically been incredibly inaccurate because it's based on census blocks, and this is something the FCC has acknowledged. It's based on census blocks rather than sort of address by address breakdown of internet access in America. So the FCC estimates roughly between 14 and 18 million people don't have broadband access, whereas outside analyses from different research groups estimate the number is as much as 42 million Americans without broadband access, or as many as 120 million if you're just talking about people who don't have internet at broadband speeds, like that what you need to stream Netflix. So the biggest first step here is actually just figuring out where to close the gap, because you can't narrow the digital divide if you don't know where it is.
Right.
And then the next step is just figuring out how much money can we afford to sort of break down this problem. And I think the issue is a lot of critics have said that the broadband subsidies aren't likely going to be big enough to do a fiber-only network across all of America. The Senate bill right now includes about $42 billion for broadband deployments, whereas some estimates say it would cost as much as $240 billion at least just to do a fiber-only network across America. So if we're trying to wire up everyone, we're not going to be able to afford it. So the question is, what are these other technologies? Do we use more satellites and fixed wireless to wire up the country, or do we just try to build as much fiber as possible with that spending in this bill?
Hey, Austin, what's the other side of this coin here? The economic cost of not having these more than 100 million Americans connected with broadband internet.
It's a tragic cost. I'm not sure if it must be difficult to quantify, but it's something that the reason there's been more emphasis on this subject is because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, a lot of folks had said that any infrastructure bill that came up, it was always about investing in roads or bridges or railroads. And when I talked to the Rural Broadband Association, they just kept saying, hey, it's also, in addition to roads and bridges, it's also broadband. It's also broadband. It's also broadband. And that didn't change. The Congress's perspective on that didn't really change until the COVID pandemic, when suddenly they realized employers couldn't have people working from home because they couldn't access Zoom, or kids couldn't work from home and do their homework because they didn't have internet access. When I was in Arkansas, I learned that a handful of kids were working outside at a local park center, a state-run park center, because it had public Wi-Fi, and they were working outside in 90-degree heat, and the park ranger brought out fans to cool them off. So that's the real tragic cost that you're seeing on the ground. I don't know if I have a quantified number for you, but that's why this debate is really coming to the forefront right now in the infrastructure bill, of trying to solve that digital divide, because, man, we saw that during the pandemic, that the U.S. is just not prepared for a remote society.
Well, a good story, Austin Carr. Thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
And we've got some breaking news crossing the Bloomberg Terminal, a Bloomberg exclusive. Facebook's chief technology officer, Mike Schoeffer, stepping down. The CTO changes posted internally by CEO Mark Zuckerberg. So let's get to it and get some clarification on this. Again, a Bloomberg exclusive. With us is Bloomberg News corporate influence reporter Naomi Nick. She's in our Interactive Broker studio. You are here. What's going on?
Yes. So Mike Schoeffer will be stepping down next year. He's currently the chief technology officer for Facebook. So he handles a lot of the areas that are actually pretty critical to Facebook's growth, like augmented reality, blockchain, virtual reality. And so this is a significant departure for Facebook.
A significant departure, and also a familiar name to people who've been watching Facebook for years, stepping up, Boz, Facebook's hardware boss, Bosworth, to become CTO next year. Tell us about Boz and his history at the company and what he's going to – and what it signals that he's becoming CTO.
Well, this is – you know, it's an interesting move for him given how much Facebook has been emphasizing its push into hardware. So it has an Oculus unit. It's also, you know, just recently released smart glasses. Facebook really sees its growth area in creating hardware devices to be kind of the next cell phone.
I got to ask you, because Facebook has been in the news a lot. We should remind everybody, too, the stock, I think, hit a four-month low in today's session. We've seen some pressure here. The New York Times has been reporting that Facebook promoted positive stories about itself on users' news feeds. We know they've come under a lot of criticism in terms of blocking misinformation on their platform. Is this at all connected? My understanding is his group is the group that I think was very much involved in removing content that violates its policies, like nudity, hate speech, and graphic violence.
Yes. I mean, he does oversee the technology that's central to those efforts for Facebook. And yeah, I mean, it is at a time where the company is really under siege from multiple investigations, from multiple news organizations, spanning, you know, the fact that there might be illegal sales of car, you know, illegal car listings on its Facebook marketplace, to how it handles human trafficking.
Is he a fall guy? And I said New York Times reporting, Wall Street Journal has done a lot of reporting, right, and others on all of this. Is he a fall guy here?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
But I would say it's at a time where Facebook has seen a number of departures for veterans. So like Fiji Simomo, who was also at Facebook recently, left to become CEO of Instacart. Carolyn Everson, who oversaw Facebook's businesses with advertisers, she also recently departed. And they were both people who were at the company for more than a decade. And so this is another one of those types of departures.
Go ahead, Carol.
I was going to say Facebook down about 0.6% in the after hours. It was down 4% in the regular trade.
Now, I mean, I'm wondering just about, again, back to Boz, because for people who've been watching Facebook, Andrew Bosworth, closely for years, a familiar name, and internally too, and this coming from an internal posting, the company recruiting from inside the company, keeping people who've been at the company a long time and elevating them, even though they've seen these departures from longtime executives very recently.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting, you know, move for Facebook, in particular because the company has gotten criticism that it's too insular in its thinking, that it drinks its own Kool-Aid and doesn't accept the perspectives of outsiders enough. And so, you know, this is one of those moves that could invite that kind of scrutiny, you know, in the future. And so the question is, if they continue to recruit within, will they change and be able to address the criticisms they're facing?
Is there a net takeaway from all of this? And I know we're going to be covering this into the Thursday trade. I'm just curious.
I would say it means that Facebook's leadership is shuffling. And the question is, will there be more departures? Will there be more reshuffling at the top? And how does that affect the direction of the company?
Yeah, on a day where Facebook closed down 4%. To Naomi over those challenges that the company's having with Apple's new privacy settings as well. Naomi Nix is social media and corporate governance reporter. She joins us live with the Bloomberg exclusive.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest has been one of the constant and consistent go-to voices throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, having a front row seat to the health crisis. Former commissioner of the FDA of the United States, he's on the boards of Illumina, Tempus, Pfizer, and more. He's a resident fellow at the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute. His new book is Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. Great to welcome here to Bloomberg Businessweek former FDA commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb on the phone from Westport, Connecticut. Dr. Gottlieb, great to have you here with Tim and myself. So much to ask you, and congratulations on the book. One thing we wanted to know, if the nation had shut down early on in the pandemic, let's say for 3 months, really shut down, federal mandatory shutdown, would we be in a better position today? And I'm just talking about the U.S. for a moment.
Yeah, I don't know that if we had implemented the stay-at-home order a lot earlier, it would have made an appreciable difference, and I don't think it would have been warranted. Certainly, once we knew that there was very dense spread in cities like New York, we should have implemented the mitigation, the stay-at-home recommendations earlier than we did. So we were a week or two late doing that in cities like New York. But the bigger problem was that we didn't have the ability to actually diagnose the infection. We didn't have a diagnostic test deployed at scale. It was something we could have done if we had proper planning. And because we didn't have a diagnostic test, not only did we not know how much spread was underway, so we were blind to the scope of the spread, and we didn't know the true nature of the threat, and that's partly why we shut down late. But we didn't know where the virus wasn't. There were parts of the country where COVID wasn't spreading yet, where we didn't have to implement the population-wide mitigation, where we could still use testing and tracing if we had a test deployed to try to contain the spread rather than telling everyone they had to stay in their homes. So that the lack of the ability to actually figure out where the virus was, but also where it wasn't, led to the wrong policy decisions.
Who made the right policy decisions at the time? What countries led the way? What countries are still leading the way? What's a good example of what we should have done?
Yeah, at the time, South Korea, I think, had probably the best initial response. I mean, every country has gone through waves of infection and made mistakes along the way. The U.S. has been disproportionately impacted by this. This has been an asymmetric risk to the United States. I think we've made a lot of mistakes along the way. But South Korea, early on, when the virus was first identified in China, got together their private industry, their diagnostic manufacturers, and promised them a very efficient process. If they got into the market, started to manufacture diagnostic kits at scale, they promised that they would be purchased by the government, and they also stood up testing sites. They started to lay the foundation for testing sites. And they actually pioneered the use of drive-through testing sites. The first drive-through testing sites were in South Korea. And because they were able to deploy diagnostic testing at a massive scale, they were able to identify their early infections, get people isolated, get people in quarantine, and keep the country from becoming epidemic. The epidemic really never took off in South Korea. I mean, they had subsequent waves of infection when B.1.1.7 and eventually the Delta variant started to spread later on.
Right.
But South Korea was on a similar trajectory of Italy and was able to contain it.
Dr. Gottlieb, why didn't we treat the warnings of a global pandemic that have been out there for years, so much so that there was a pandemic playbook conceived of during the Bush administration? Why wasn't that already in place? You've been on the inside. You've been involved in government on and off, I think, since roughly 2003. Why didn't we have the follow through? And I'm curious the conversations that you had about this.
Look, we had a pandemic playbook, and you're right. We had prepped a pandemic contingency. In fact, the government had run a simulation called Crimson Contagion just before COVID struck, which was a simulated pandemic. The problem is we had always prepped for a pandemic involving a flu. We never envisioned that a pandemic could be caused, certainly by a coronavirus. We never envisioned anything but influenza. And the playbook that we had written for flu wasn't fully applicable to a coronavirus. There were many things that were different about this virus and about any coronavirus that don't make the kinds of contingencies that you develop for a flu widely applicable. For example, flu has a short incubation period, meaning that when you're exposed to it, you get sick from it pretty quickly, and typically you're not contagious until you develop symptoms. So trying to diagnose people who are asymptomatic carriers of the flu isn't as efficient. First of all, once they're exposed, they're going to become sick very quickly, and you're going to be able to identify them because they're going to have symptoms. When they're contagious, they have symptoms. With a coronavirus with a long incubation period, there's more of an opportunity to get someone diagnosed before they go on to spread the virus. And we also know that there's a lot of asymptomatic transmission with the coronavirus, with COVID. So it's more important to have a diagnostic test deployed where you're screening the population. So a lot of the things that we thought about that were planned for flu weren't applicable. We also tried to stockpile certain materials like respirators and masks,
right,
which we found out the stockpiles weren't well maintained, so we didn't have the equipment that we needed.
But I do want to push you a little bit, Dr. Gottlieb, about what were the internal conversations you were having at your time in the government when it comes to, hey, folks, we got to do something more serious. We got to make sure we've got the right things in place.
Yeah, at the time that I was in government, we really didn't have our eye on anything but influenza.
How did we miss it? How did we miss it, especially that since there's a lot of vaccine hunters that are out there that we've talked to a bunch here at Bloomberg? They've been looking at this and seeing things that are out there that could be significant problems.
Yeah, certainly back in 2005 when the pandemic planning first began, that's when I was involved with it. We were really worried about a bird flu, H5N1. At that point, coronaviruses really hadn't emerged. But after SARS and MERS both emerged, we should have had the awareness that the coronaviruses were on the march. They were becoming more pathogenic. They were starting to threaten humans. And that a more contagious variation of SARS could come along and threaten the entire globe. Really, what we should have been focused on is a broad category of viruses, viruses that replicate through RNA, because a virus that replicates through RNA means that it can undergo rapid mutation, and viruses that could spread through respiratory droplets or aerosols. So those two features, viruses that replicate through RNA and spread through aerosols, are what give a virus the qualities that could create global contagion. And if you're looking at it through that lens, you're looking at that broad category. That includes influenza for sure, but it also includes coronaviruses, includes Nipah virus. It broadens the universe of the potential threats that could be the next pandemic.
Still with us is Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Pfizer, and Illumina board member. He is also a special partner with the venture capital firm New Enterprise Associates. And let's not forget the reason he's here. He's got an interesting and comprehensive new book. It's called Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. I already, Tim, are thinking about the next pandemic.
Yeah, and so is Dr. Gottlieb. Dr. Gottlieb, you dedicate this book to your three daughters. You're a dad, and I think that a lot of parents listening right now want to know about risk tolerance and about the way that you are behaving and the way that you want your family to behave during a pandemic when perhaps some of kids are not vaccinated and some kids are old enough to be vaccinated. What are you doing with your family right now? What is safe to you? What's not safe to you?
Yeah, look, my kids are not vaccinated yet. They're not old enough to be vaccinated. They're under the age of 11. They will be vaccinated once they turn 12 and they're eligible. I think a lot of the residual anxiety that people who are vaccinated feel right now around COVID is the risk that they're going to bring an asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infection back into the home, put their children at risk or an elderly parent at risk, someone that they might be caring for who is at more significant risk of having a bad outcome from COVID. I think once the vaccine can be extended to children, a lot of people who are vaccinated themselves and don't feel personally at risk from COVID, that they feel reasonably confident that if they were to get infected, that they're going to be protected from a severe outcome, I think they'd feel more confident about going out and about. And that's why I think a lot of people are still cautious. People who are vaccinated probably overestimate their risk in some cases. They're probably more protected than what they perceive. People who are unvaccinated, quite frankly, I think are underestimating their risk. They're probably at much more risk from COVID than they perceive. But I think a lot of the residual anxiety that people feel around the virus is around kids. And hopefully we'll have a vaccine for children very soon.
Fingers crossed. You're, as we mentioned, a Pfizer board member. Do you care whether your kids get a Pfizer booster or vaccine, excuse me, whether it's Moderna, whether it's J&J? Do you have any preferences?
I think all three of these vaccines are safe and effective. All three of them have demonstrated really robust protection, including the J&J vaccine. And J&J is going to be able to produce much more vaccine in the months ahead. And that the data on that vaccine looks very encouraging when we see long-term data and the durability of the response. And so I'm impartial to what vaccine my children receive. Probably they're going to get the Pfizer vaccine because it's accessible to me. But I'm impartial to what they receive. I think all three of these vaccines are outstanding.
And I have to be quite honest with you. Tim and I talk about this every day with doctors and the medical community. I think there is a feeling like, I got the Pfizer vaccine, I got the Moderna vaccine. Like, there is a feeling that one is better than another. You've got a huge audience right now, a global audience. I mean, what do you say to them? How do we understand, especially as we continue to see studies out there, officials, regulations, you know, come in about these vaccines?
Yeah, it's not what the data shows. When you can pull any one study and try to make a claim that one vaccine might be slightly more beneficial than another vaccine in terms of its long-term efficacy or the absolute potency of the effectiveness that it's delivering. But the totality of the data really shows that these vaccines are interchangeable and all are providing durable protection. And they're all doing their job. They're fulfilling the original premise. Remember, the original premise of these vaccines was that they would protect you against severe disease and hospitalization. And all three vaccines are proving very effective at that.
I think something really frustrating to a lot of people right now, Dr. Gottlieb, is there's still, you know, you write about the lack of real-time testing and available testing, even, you know, almost 2 years into when we first discovered this. I still walk into a drugstore and I cannot get a Binance test, right? One of those from Abbott
right.
Labs. And I can't order them online. The availability is still not there. So you write about it in your book, How to Prepare for the Next Pandemic. We're still not getting through this one right now. We're still not learning the lessons that we should have learned almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, the problem is that we didn't scale the production of the tests that consumers prefer. What consumers want are at-home tests that they can deploy themselves that are easy to use, where they can get a readable result right in the privacy of their home. A lot of the tests that are available on the market that aren't selling out are the ones that either require you to send a swab off overnight so you don't get an instantaneous result, or you have to upload some data that the test reads out to get a result on your iPhone, and therefore you're reporting the result to an authority. People want to be able to test themselves within the privacy of their own home and make a determination what they do with that result. And those are the Binax Now tests, to your point, which are selling out, the Lumera test, which isn't available. So the tests that consumers want are the ones that aren't available. I think companies probably miscalculated and didn't fully appreciate what consumer preferences would be. But the reality is that this is a completely new category. The whole idea of making at-home tests available to diagnose patients for infectious diseases, that's a new category. That's been created in the setting of COVID. Before COVID, FDA wouldn't authorize those tests.
Do we need a division in the government, Dr. Gottlieb, that is just devoted to pandemics? Because right now it's a lot of hands in the pot.
Yeah, I think what we need is a reformed CDC. There was an expectation that CDC had the operational capacity really to mount a national-level response to a public health crisis of this magnitude, surface real-time information to inform policymakers, do real-time analytics to inform consumers on how to reduce their individual risk, scale the production of a diagnostic test. They didn't have the capability to do any of those things. It's a very retrospective mindset in the organization. It's a high-science organization that does deep analytical work, but takes months to render conclusions. We need a much different mindset and capability, but I think we should keep it within CDC. To take it out of CDC and just create a new agency,
right,
is going to be too politically difficult.
Hey, Dr. Gottlieb, I got to ask you about FDA, because as I was reminded in an NPR article this morning, the FDA has been without a permanent leader for 8 months. Did you see that as former FDA commissioner? Do you see that as being an issue during the pandemic?
I don't think it's an issue during the pandemic. The agency's got a very good commissioner in Janet Woodcock, who I work with, who ran the drug center. And the reality is, I think that Janet's been able to function very effectively in that organization because she knows the organization. If you had brought a politically appointed commissioner in from the outside who wasn't familiar with FDA, they might not have been as effective day one in that organization in the setting of a public health crisis. So having an experienced leader, I think, has actually
right.
been a good thing.
Hey, listen, just got about 40, 50 seconds left. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, tell us who you hope reads this book.
Well, I certainly hope policymakers read it on Capitol Hill. I think we need to start having the discussion in earnest about how we prepare better for the next pandemic and how we make the country more resilient and look at public health preparedness through the lens of national security. So I'm hoping that this gets picked up in Washington and people start to think about how we should engage in better planning for the future.
Well, there's a lot of information for everyone to read about and figure out the next playbook so that we are prepared. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, thank you so much. Much appreciation from Tim and myself. Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic, of course, from the former head of the FDA.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Great. So great coverage by our surveillance team there, TV, radio, simulcast of the Fed meeting. Largely what we expected, although, Tim, great to say. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic here on Bloomberg Business Week on this Fed Wednesday. It also happens to be, I believe, the first day of spring. Fall.
Is it? Yeah, it is. Happy fall.
Yeah, first day of fall. And we did get some clarity when it comes to what the Fed might do next and when.
We did. And interestingly enough, we're not seeing a significant market reaction either when it comes to fixed income markets or when it comes to the equity market. And I think it's fair to say that that's a win for the Fed. Means that they have been transparent, that they've been
spoon-feeding that information, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So let's see what our guest has to say. We'll continue talking about the Fed, and let's do a little bit more with Megan Horniman. She's Director of Portfolio Strategy at the Wealth Advisory and Multifamily Office Firm, Verdance Capital Advisor. She is with us on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland, who, by the way, if you check out her bio, if she was not a financial advisor, she would be a coach for the Special Olympics or the Invictus Games. So I'm delighted to have you here, Megan. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good, good. I do wonder if this was an Olympic sport, watching the Fed, what might it be?
that's a very interesting question. I guess it would. You'd have to pick one of the Olympic sports that's very slow and steady. That is something that they are definitely articulating to us. They don't want to surprise us in any way. They're going to be very methodical about how they go about, you know, tapering bond purchases, how they unwind some of this non-traditional policy. And as you mentioned before, they're being very transparent about it. So that's not really surprising the markets right now.
If it were figure skating or perhaps gymnastics and judges were holding up numbers and giving grades, what grade would you give Fed Chair Powell at the end of that press conference? Scale of 1 to 10.
I think it, 1 to 10. He did very well. The reason why I think he did very well is because he didn't surprise anybody. I think that that anybody could have expected he was going to come out kind of toe the line on both sides, where he would say, we're acknowledging the fact inflation's running a little bit hot. They did increase their inflation expectations for this year and a little bit for next year. But at the same time, the economy is not quite ready for them to raise rates. So they're able to really satisfy both sides of the fence. They can satisfy those people that think that inflation is running too hot and they have to do something, and then also satisfy those that think it's transitory and there's more risk to the economic environment going forward.
Hey, Megan, as someone who has to determine portfolio strategy at your firm, so based on what the Fed does, are you thinking about new strategies maybe going into the new year or even the remaining months of this year?
No, for the remaining months of this year, we're still being very patient because I think there's a lot of risks still that need to be addressed. Obviously, the Fed.
So what does be patient mean? What's your like allocations or where do you want to be exposed to?
Right. So when I say patient is we're being patient with some of the overweight cash position that we have. We have a modestly slight overweight to cash, and that's because we think you really need to have dry powder in this type of an environment. Even though we've seen volatility over the past couple weeks, you're still looking at valuations that look stretched across a lot of areas, specifically even here in the U.S. markets. So we're being patient to allocate some of that cash. The areas that we like.
Did you allocate on Monday or Tuesday when we saw the pullback?
No, because if you look at it from top to bottom, it's still about 4%.
Yeah, that's true.
So we still haven't gotten that 5% pullback in the S&P 500 this entire calendar year, and that's rare. So I think that some of the risks that we are still monitoring, obviously seasonality, you know, there are a lot of people who mention that. We are closing down September, but there have been some instances September and October can be a little bit choppy. The other thing is the political situation is very uncertain right now, and it seems like while it's taking a backseat to some other news, there is a lot of falling apart there in some of these different deals that are supposed to be struck, especially we have the debt ceiling at the end of this month, and you're hearing Yellen's voice get a bit louder as far as trying to get them to come to some form of an agreement. And then even if they do punt some of this down the road, we're still going to have more infighting in a political standpoint before the end of this year. So I think the political standpoint, while we don't trade around short-term political events, it is something that I think could spook the markets, and you could get some other buying opportunities. The other thing is just from
a buying opportunity, a buying opportunity of what, a 5% decline, a 10% pullback. What do you consider a buying opportunity if Monday wasn't enough?
Right. So, I mean, if you look at just some technicals, you're still looking at least another 7 to 10% from here to fall down to the 200-day moving average on the S&P 500. We did bounce off that 50-day moving average, so that held a little bit of support there. But from, technicals, we like to look at that 200-day moving average as it's kind of been a long-term support. I think that that would be another opportunity. And then I also think that we have to get a little bit more clarity from the corporate tax perspective, because to be able to look at to value stocks and look from a PE multiple perspective, I don't think that the earnings estimates are truly pricing in the chance for corporate tax hikes. So I think there could be some downward revisions to earnings depending on what magnitude of corporate tax hikes we get.
Even if the corporate tax hike is something in the range of 26.5% and not 28%?
I mean, is this really going to be a problem for companies?
Gina Martin Adams says it is. She was on Quick Take Stock earlier today, and she actually said
fewer what?
Aren't the big, Carol, you always say this, the big companies find a way to get around it.
They do. Come on, Megan, right?
Yeah, they do. And you mentioned the buybacks and other things, but it's going to depend also from an international, what they do with the international revenues.
Global minimum tax, there. Right?
Yeah, like because that's some of our bigger companies that make up a lot of the earnings in the S&P 500. So there's a lot of moving parts here. At the end of the day, the one thing that would benefit, I think, even if we do get the corporate tax hike, let's say it becomes more aggressive Biden gets everything that he originally wanted from the corporate tax perspective, some of the things that it'll do is push forward CapEx spending, because they haven't really made any changes from the depreciation, part of the Trump tax cut. So I think you'll get more CapEx spending from companies, especially if they're going to be taxed on whether it's buybacks or dividends go up. I think you'll see more CapEx spending, and that's positive for the economy.
Megan, I want to ask you, because I think I know the answer. I think going into this meeting, you were constructive and liked the financial area. We did see the KBW mm-hmm. Bank Index move up following the mm-hmm. Fed decision.
Yeah, if you look over the past few months, some of the things that have been constraining the financials and the value, those cyclical types of sectors, has been the fact that, we have the Delta variant, which has got the people concerned a little bit about that reopening trade, but interest rates have stayed low. So every time we keep interest rates low, you tend to see those expensive growth type of sectors, your technology, communication services, they tend to rally. But what did you see today? You saw the long end of the curve back up a bit, and that's beneficial for financials. We like financials because we think that interest rates right now are just, there's no justifiable reason why they should be this low. When the Fed does start to taper.
At some point, they've got to go a little bit higher, one would think, right?
Yes. Yes, I think that they're set to go higher over the next 12 months, and in that environment, it should be good for financials.
That's the question. I mean,
no, we definitely saw it play out here. Where don't you want to be? Just got about 30 seconds, 40 seconds.
Fixed income, long-term fixed income. Yeah. I'd be short-term fixed income. And then also I would be very careful around the expensive growth, large cap areas. I'd rather be looking at international.
Are you sure you want to take that trade? Because every time everybody takes it, we just see more money go into it.
Yeah, that's true. But then you also see days where you see all that money running for the door. So I'd rather not be one trying to squeeze out the door.
All right. Good stuff. Hey, listen, thank you. Thank you. A pleasure. And hope you'll come back real soon. Megan Horniman, she's Director of Portfolio Strategy at the Wealth Advisory and Multifamily Office Firm Verdance Capital. She's joining us from Hunt Valley, Maryland. What?
Speaking of fixed income, I did think it was funny and kind of notable when Chair Powell was talking about trading activity by Fed officials. And he mentioned that he had munis. And traditionally, it's not something that's
for
Fed
a long
kind of
time, he said. That they'd been
time.
In his portfolio.
Yeah.
Right. I
kind of chuckled at that.
It's going to happen, right? Especially, these are guys who have lots of money and have been putting it to work for some time. And so you do wonder about overlap, especially when it comes to policy.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.